Now you have the opportunity to buy a unique poster containing a screenshot of every single millennial stream ever. The entire smorgasbord, the full gamut, the whole shebang, all in one incredible display commemorating the first decade of this festival. Available in portrait or landscape. Buy yours now.
Hello and welcome back to Millennial X. This is the final night, and this is a stream that was only arranged, a couple of days ago. It's with, obviously, the Austrian activist Martin Sellner, who has appeared on Millennial before 2 years ago. He was going to be in the Germanosphere banquet, I think 2 days ago, but he wasn't able to make it. So we've arranged this instead, which I think is a good idea. So, Martin, welcome back to Millennial.
Thanks for having me. I'm very happy to be back, and sorry again for me missing the banquet. I really would have liked to come, but I was not able to come. So I'm very happy we could make it work on the last day of the Millennial.
I'm glad as well. I should say that tonight, after this, there will be the Morgoth stream and then the outro AME. So that will be, and then that'll be it for this year. But the Germanosphere banquet went well. There was Lichtmess, Niels Wegner, Schattenmacher, and Stefan from Switzerland, from the TMOS magazine. So it was good. I think it was a good conversation. So, Martin, 2024, I would say, obviously, I'll ask you what you thought of the year, but I would say that it was a good year for you with the spread of our ideas, let's say.
Yeah, definitely. Many aspects. I think we were really able to leave a mark. Maybe a dent even in the, you know, opponent system, especially when it came to the term remigration. So I think it was definitely a metapolitical success. And then we also had a lot of political successes in Austria, the elections in the eastern parts of Germany, obviously in the United States. Trump also won. I mean, a lot of people are already a bit blackpilled about Trump. I can understand the reasons, but I think Altogether, it was a very successful year that definitely gives me a lot of hope that there's a shift in the public opinion in the West, that wokeness has reached and overstepped its peak, and that there's a chance for a real political change. I don't think it will come by itself, but I think there's a window of opportunity in the next years.
What do you think has happened? Why do you think that people have... the woke thing is passing. Do you agree that it has peaked and is now on the way out? And if so, why do you think that's happened?
I think it has peaked already years ago, but I think also that certain people, certain elite circles apparently don't want wokeness anymore. I think it created a lot of financial damage for the for these corporations, yes, but the point of propaganda is never to make profits. It wasn't like this in the Soviet Union or any totalitarian system. So I think that there also has been kind of a change in the elite circles. They understand probably, and they know probably, that we will go, especially in Europe, in a time with a deep crisis, without any bread and circuses, or with fewer bread and circuses. So I think they at least want these weapons of mass distractions, bread and circuses, to really work and to really distract people. And I think they understand they have to curb it a bit down with Black Lives Matters, anti-whiteness, anti-male ideology, and give people some real slop, so to say, again, that can distract them. So I think in a way they want to revive the entertainment, the popular culture maybe of the 80s. They want to create a new compromise, I think, with those people who are really frustrated. They want to get the rising right in Europe and in other countries and win them over again and implement them again in the system. So that's what is going to come, in my opinion. I don't claim that the whole thing is a conspiracy theory. I really think that there's a lot of anger and frustration. There's a genuine victory that is directly attributed to our metapolitical work. But I think especially because of the economic situation, the demographic situation in the world, also some elites are trying to adapt already.
For years there was the thing about go woke, go broke. Sorry, but by the way, my microphone has suddenly decided to, there's a bit of a malfunction, but I think it's going to work.
I hear you very well.
For years there was the go woke, go broke thing. And I think it seems to have really happened now, especially with the Amazon Lord of the Rings nonsense and the all of that, the Marvel heroes. But also in the real world, it just seems that mass immigration has now reached such a peak, such a height that ordinary people cannot escape it. Who would have escaped it a few years? Just 5 years ago, let's say.
True. No, I agree. I think also you cannot really hide it anymore, the consequences of mass migration. And I think, but I really think it's due to an upcoming economic crisis that they know. And that's the reason why you've seen this 180 turn from Trudeau, from Keir Starmer, why suddenly now a lot of German politicians try to have an anti-immigration position. I don't think it's true. I don't think they will fulfill the promises. If they do, they'll just do some remigration stunts, like deport the worst criminal with a lot of media covering it. But obviously they will not stop the great replacement and they will not start a real remigration. I think it's just a plunder. I think they just want to basically distract people for a few more years until you can't really change anything anymore. But they've seen that with this old ideology, with like nobody cares about global warming anymore, with anti-white ideology, with this politics of guilt, the book is behind me in my bookshelf by coincidence, they will not win anything anymore. And so a lot of our positions will become mainstream and they'll try to move the Overton window a little bit to the right and then freeze it there again. And that's, I think, what's going to happen in the next years. But obviously, that's a very, very good environment for us to spread information and to win people over.
Do you think that's the purpose of the woke right meme? To sort of freeze things just before 100%. Identitarianism?
100%. I think it's very interesting that they bring this all cooked up thing again now. I still remember when Sargon of Akkad was on this train and made his videos about identity politics, which is bad, whether on the left or on the right. You know, it's a very old argument.
The right-wing SJWs.
Exactly. Now, I think he has a different opinion right now. But the likes of Lindsay, I think, what's his name? James Lindsay, not Lindsey Graham. Lindsey Graham is a different guy. Do you know this Lindsay guy?
Yes, James Lindsay.
These Anglo-Saxon names all sound the same for me as an Austrian, and you all look a bit the same. So that's how I see it. No, I think that's very lame. It's very stupid. It will not work at all. It's the argument is completely crazy. But what I think is very, very interesting. So I would think now. I think we can say now in a coalition of Trump, of the bigger MAGA movement, we have the Silicon Valley libertarian tech pro guys who want the country just to run with capitalism uber alles, like Miles Cheong said. Then I would say you have the MAGA guys who are economic populists, who are for kind of an economic patriotism, likes of Steve Bannon, who but still have this boomer truth color blindness idea behind them. And then you have the alt-right, you can call them ethno-nationalist, identitarian, whatever you might call them. I would say it's like a dissident right. People who understand that it's also about demography, that ethno-cultural identity plays a role. And they kind of have an alliance and they overlap on certain segments. And I think especially this H1B debate is interesting because here you have a very strong coalition and alliance between the MAGA economic patriots and the dissident right, the maybe identitarian right.
Yes.
Who are, I think, winning this conversation on X. So this is my perspective.
Yeah, it's an interesting alliance, isn't it? It's not one that I would have expected. But it seems to have, I think that the MAGA types in America have just got tired of capitalism. I think they've got tired of pretending that, well, anyone can just come to America. And of course, the same is true of our countries as well. But with MAGA in America, it's like, I think for a long time, like up until through Trump's first presidency, I think the MAGA types were still up for quite a lot of globalism. But I think now, maybe because the economics in America are not good, they've turned against that. And so when the tech bros say that they want the H1Bs, it's unacceptable to them. So it's interesting because there was always this gap between the MAGA crowd and the dissident right, but it seems that they've sort of come round to our side on this.
I agree. But I think it's especially because there's a very bad argumentative position for the tech bros because they accuse the critics of H1B as being racist. But people like Bannon say, no, it's not about race, it's about citizenship. And he said, we need to have more Hispanics and Black people in Silicon Valley before we can bring Indians. So basically, this argument against legal skilled immigration can also be done just from a citizenship constitutional standpoint without bringing up any question of IQ or demography. So I think that's the reason what makes this legal immigration point so weak and so attackable. But still, it's definitely my opinion, although it's, of course, disappointing to see censorship coming again back on X and see how basically how unstable this alliance really is. So the honeymoon phase was quite short. I don't say this what happened is a win. Obviously, it would be a win if people like Musk really would become dissident rightists. But what is definitely positive, in my opinion, is that now the American sphere is debating about legal immigration. There's a huge scrutiny. The autistic research bros are going through all the databases. And from day one, legal skilled immigration will be under total surveillance of this sphere. And we are not even talking about illegal immigration anymore. And by talking about legal immigration, H1B, whether you're for it or you're against it, in a performative way, you are affirming that illegal immigration has to stop and that mass repatriations have to start. So I hope that this point becomes now even more clear and that Musk and Trump will at least do this in a big extent. That's my hope for the coming year.
Yeah. Do you think that is more likely to happen in America or in European countries? At the present moment, where do you think is more likely to go in that direction of repatriation? Do you think America or Europe?
To be honest, I have to say a real remigration policy is more realistic in Europe. That's my opinion. So first of all, also I'm not the biggest, I don't have the biggest knowledge of America. I mean, I watch these videos, I follow the debates, but it's just a European perspective. And I'm also not here to say Americans how remigration or identitarianism should look like in America. That's an American thing to say. You know, it's not my place to talk here as an Austrian. Yeah. But I think Europe definitely has higher chances because in Europe, the economy will go way worse in the coming years. America just still has this amazing geography, this very, very good soil. They have fracking, so that there's a real problem in the distribution of goods or a scarcity of goods is very unlikely in America. And then people are always more willing to accept weapons of mass destruction, bread and circuses, or just move away, which you can also do in America because there's so much space. this does not exist in Europe. There is no space. There will be a huge scarcity in Europe, a huge conflict, and this conflict will not be a class war. Definitely clear. We'll have no Bernie Sanders movements. We'll have no multi-ethnic class coalitions. The communists will fail. We'll definitely have, in one way or another, an ethnic dimension. And I think that's the reason why all these politicians are now trying to, so to say, sell and dump off their multiculturalism stocks and buy into the remigration stock, because they know it will inevitably rise. And if they do it right now, they can say, I've changed my mind already. So that's what's going to happen. And I think because of the big crisis, because of the lack of resources bread and circuses, Europe is a hot candidate for having the first real remigration policies in the next years.
Yeah, I agree. I wanted to get to remigration later, because it's obviously a huge topic and it's very much your thing. But for now, let's talk about the AfD in Germany, the Alternative for Deutschland, because that is, to me, a fascinating story. The rise of this party and its apparent, it just seems to go from strength to strength. How would you explain that, where this party has come from, how it's been so successful, and its current condition, and the future for it?
I think the AfD is a very, very curious case, because Germany was based on this premise that there shall and never can be a right-wing populist party. The Freedom Party in Austria, a country where I live, is very old. It was formed right after the Second World War for the so-called third camp, because they always knew there are conservatives, conservatives, and then the socialists. But there's also a third way, a third option, you know. And these were obviously like more nationalistic people, and they needed a political party representation. This was the Freedom Party, which was a very small party until Jörg Haider created and invented right-wing populism. It's an Austrian gift to the world in the 90s. And in Germany, any attempt to create a right-wing populist party was quelled and completely crushed by the state very, very quickly. And it was the CDU who said, nothing can be right from us. Like, right from us is only hell. And they were very successful with that. And then there were parties like the pro parties, the Republicans and others, and they had some kind of success, had some right-wing populist leaders, but then they were completely destroyed and they were branded as neo-Nazis. They had actual crazy people joining them and they were crushed. They never could become too big to fail. And the AfD managed to do this because of very good circumstances. It was a lucky coincidence. First, it was the euro crisis. So it was the economic crisis and Germany had to bail out Greece and many other European countries. There was a big frustration and it was an amazing moment for economic patriotism, economic nationalism in Germany.
And that when was that? Was that in 2009?
Exactly. Yeah, 2008-09. And that was when the AfD was formed as a party of academics. The guy was called Bernd Lucke. He's like as boring as, white bread, but he was a professor and he was only talking about that Germany should go out of the Eurozone, Germany should not pay for the debts of other countries. Very compelling. And then this party and Lucke at the beginning were, and that's my conspiracy theory, but there's a lot of hints for that, they were supported by the left in Germany. So all the media invited Lucke. And they were talking about the AfD in a very interesting way because their idea was to fragment the German right. Because on the German right, you only had the CDU, a huge party bloc, and then you had the AfD, a small libertarian party. And on the left, you had the Greens, the Socialists, the Communists, and they always had a big problem because they were fragmented and the right was united. That was while you had this Merkel and this huge area of CDU. And so I think they thought, okay, if we have this new libertarian populist party, you know, that's amazing because then the CDU has some concurrence. And that's why there was a phase where the AfD, like 3-4 years, could just grow. There were no attacks. It looked just like a very harmless Euro criticism party. And then suddenly, 2015 happened. And that polarized everything. Migration became the main issue. Bernd Lucke said, no, we don't talk about migration. We only talk about economy. But he was basically ousted, chased away. And suddenly all these Euroskeptics realized, hey, we're also migration skeptics. We also don't like migration. And overnight, the party became a huge anti-migration party, but was already too big then, 8-9% too big to fail. And it had so many intelligent people, lawyers, professors, entrepreneurs in it. So much human capital that has never, ever would have joined one of these very bad and nasty right-wing parties. And that was a coincidence of history. And then they couldn't shut it down anymore.
That's brilliant. It's like it happened by accident almost. From the point of view of the left, like they actually helped it. And then it's like creating this, the cliche of I've created a monster sort of thing.
Trust me, if this coincidence did not happen, we would have now, like in the East, in the West, 3, 4, 5 different parties. The NPD would probably have 6-7% again. Then there would be a libertarian party, an anti-COVID party. There would be kind of an anti-Muslim party like Geert Wilders. You know, we had some kind of these parties again who only talk about Islam, and they would have like 3-5%, and they would create voting alliances, and they would crumble afterwards. And that would be, I think, the case. And most people will still vote for the CDU. So I think that this was a nice coincidence.
Yeah, yeah. We should point out that the CDU is Merkel's party. That's the one that she's associated with. Of course, she's retired now. But just to put it in context for people who don't know that, So the AfD is now too big to ban. Really, they can't do it. Do you think that will change? Do you think that they'll decide, well, we just have to ban it? Because even if it's ridiculous, we just have to. Or is that just impossible now?
I don't think that they are going to do this any longer. They tried to do it at the beginning of 2024. This was when there were constant articles about the AfD needs to be banned, it should be banned, it's possible to ban it. And it looked like predictive programming for a real ban. And then you had Potsdam, you know, this huge gaslighting of about a new conference, like the Wannsee conference happening. And they wanted to take Björn Höcke's right to be an elected politician away, which you also can do by the German constitution. But then this talk completely died off over summer. And I think in the back, back rooms, they just decided, okay, it would be a bad idea. Why? There's several reasons. First of all, such a trial can take years. And during those years, it will give the AfD more credence. They would win one election after another and would become even bigger. And then they would be banned and would form under a new name. So it's a losing game in terms of resources. Second of all, very interesting, maybe some English listeners don't know it. You know what they have to do from day one when a trial like this starts?
Guess. No, I don't. No, I don't.
They have to take out all of the fats. All of the fats have to be taken out of the party.
Right, because this is what happened with a different party that was...
Exactly.
The
so we have to take all the fats. Would be very interesting to see who suddenly leaves the party. And then also everything that is part of the reason why the AfD should be banned that was done by a fat cannot be used, which basically would out all the right-wing fats that have infiltrated the party. And we know this. You know, we know just for one region of the AfD, a smaller one, I think there are 60... confirmed federal agents in the party, you know, or like paid people there. So if you just scale it up, at least 900, I would say 1,500 people in the AfD probably are feds. So I think what they try to do now is to basically divide et impera, destroy the party from within, kill all the real good people in the party, and slowly and steadily try to castrate the party. And turn it into a party of the system. So I think that's what they agree
on. Center right sort of party. Well, one thing I heard was that the AfD consider their youth wing to be too radical and are looking to dissolve it. Is that true? And do you think it will happen?
Yeah, well, so basically they want to integrate it into the party. So they want to dissolve it and then recreate it in the AfD at the same time. Which obviously will give them less autonomy. They claim it's the reason for this is to protect the youth wing from being banned, because at the moment they're an autonomous organization, and they could actually be legally banned from one day to another just by a ministerial order by our Minister of Interior, who has been banning right-wing movements almost every month they even tried to ban a right-wing magazine that I write for. They raided the
magazines.
Exactly. Hey, you are a pro about German politics.
Well, Lichtmess tells me everything.
Okay, yeah, good. You have a secret source of information. It didn't work, but obviously a lot of people have pointed out the idea of protection for the youth wing, for the Junge Alternative, might be not the real reason, especially since a lot of people think that the youth organization already is protected by the party status of the AfD, but they just want to have more control. And that is definitely the case, in my opinion. They want to bring this youth movement under control. And then you've seen a lot of very good politicians in the AfD who are being ousted, sidelined, isolated. In the new party program, probably they won't even use the term remigration. There are many, many hints. There was, for example, a remigration resolution in Bavaria, and then one of the AfD chiefs, they have two chiefs right now, like a dual chiefdom, Kropala, distanced himself from this resolution. You see the hints everywhere. And I think that the AfD actually is not in the best state at the moment. I think it's one of the worst states of its history, because normally when those things happened, you had a very strong base in the party that performed a palace revolution within the party. That's how we got rid of Lucke, then got rid of Meuthen. But now this is not the case, because you have Kropala and Weidel, who are, I mean, the good politicians are better than everyone else in Germany. Weidel is very gifted and talented, and Kropala says a lot of things that are true and right. But they also do a lot of things that I would criticize, especially some of the things that Kropala said. And there's no champion who really is criticizing and who is challenging them. That's a problem we have right now in the AfD. And there's no organization for the right-wing, authentic base in the party. So at the moment, I have mixed feelings when it comes to the party.
So that's concerning. Do you think that this seems to be the case, that the story with a lot of right-wing parties, that they start off in a good condition, but as they grow, they, like Marine Le Pen in France, for example, as they grow, they become more cucky for one reason or another. Do you think that's a danger with the AfD? Sounds like it is.
Absolutely. I call this behavior parliamentary patriotism. So people think like politics only takes place in the parliament. But I think that the biggest problem is that those people don't want to normalize right-wing ideas like remigration, but they want to normalize right-wing brands like themselves and their party name. So for them, it's important to come in the center of the Overton window as a political party. And I think it's easy to go in there by throwing off all controversial ideas and persons. But that's exactly what political parties should not do. So very often, it's a misunderstanding. For example, Meloni has this term of de-demonization. And I'm 100% for de-demonization. But I'm for the de-demonization of remigration and our ideas. And not for the de-demonization of Miss Meloni or Miss Le Pen by getting rid of remigration. And a metaphor I always use is like when you have to deliver a pizza, and then to be there earlier, you just throw out the pizza and arrive there with an empty box. And that's how these politicians are. They're as disappointing as empty boxes, because at the end, since they've given up many, many of the principles, of the right-wing principles, like they don't talk about people anymore. They don't like talk about remigration anymore, or about ethno-cultural identity, demography. And then in the end, when they really arrive in power, they have nothing to offer anymore, like an empty pizza box. And that's why it needs movements, intellectuals, activists, media outside of the party who are not paid by the party, not controllable by the party, and criticize them in a constructive way. That's, I think, what's the most important. That's why I think it's very good that this debate also happened in America. One important thing I wanted to add, because we talked only skimmed it briefly, this H1B thing. I read some articles about Musk now, and what they basically say, these tech bros, is we need to get rid of all racists in the Republican Party, and in a way want to paint identitarianism as racism. So they say, when you are against the Great Replacement, you are national DEI activists, and you are right, White Lives Matter activists, you're racist. That's obviously completely wrong. because when you want to preserve your ethnic cultural identity, it doesn't make you racist, it's clear. But I think it's very important to make this argument really visibly wrong and failing. So I think at the moment it's even more important, optics, you know, this debate about this, not to give these people further by linking our arguments, which are true, which are humane, which are rational, which are good, with stupid and unnecessary, like real slander and hatred and, you know, stupid jokes. So if I was an enemy of remigration right now, what I would do is create a bot army of people who only create really the most disgusting and ugly, hate-filled content that is being mixed and linked to remigration, to right-wing identitarian forces, because this would then, in a way, be the corpus delicti, the evidence for people in the AfD, in the Freedom Party, in the GOP, who want to get rid of the whole idea set, to say, okay, that's disgusting, we get rid of this by we weed it out, like Musk said. And that's a bit of a danger right now, in my opinion. That's what we need to be aware of.
Yeah, it's the sullying, tarnishing the brand by putting in extremist stuff that is not necessary. It doesn't actually help. It's more trouble than it's worth. You can argue for this stuff very rationally and very reasonably. In the end, I mean, everyone else does it. Everyone else fights for their own group. Everyone else wants the best for their own group. And they're very open about it. So why shouldn't we do the same thing? It's just sensible.
You know, all these H1P arguments eat themselves. If all these Indian IT guys are so amazing, like, why isn't Japan importing them? You know, why isn't India like keeping them and lifting up the country? And if it's DEI, nativistic racism to just even like take you and put your own workers first, then it would be even racist as a family father to help your children and save your children first before others. So basically say any kind of in-group preference is evil, and that's why we have to accept foreign in-group preference. That's quite stupid. By the way, a side note, this thing I'm drinking right now, I don't always drink Red Bull. I didn't have so much sleep, so that's why I'm constantly sipping this Red Bull.
All right. Okay. Don't worry.
I know it's unhealthy. Because whenever I drink this, a lot of people say, it's super unhealthy. It's poison. You know, you shouldn't drink it.
Right. Yes, I understand. Well, don't worry. The image is quite grainy, so I don't think anyone could have made it out. Anyway, don't worry about it. I mean, I actually had an argument just today on Twitter with some American woman, and she was saying, in fact, I can probably find the exact wording, because, and I retweeted it and said, you know, this is such an alien notion of society that this woman has to me, because it's right, here we go. So she said, you people are entitled, unqualified morons who think just because their great grandfathers lived here, that's in America, that somehow entitles you to unmerited steps up the ladder. You aren't owed anything. Work hard for what you want, or it will be taken away. Now, and I said, I just can't imagine having this notion of society, that it doesn't owe its people anything and can freely increase their hardship by adding more competitive people to the mix. It's a nightmare dystopian vision, and this person seems entirely unaware. And I think this seems to be an idea of society that has been created, encouraged by the right, by the center-right, the capitalists and so on, in order to, just so that capitalism can reign supreme, so that it doesn't have any barriers. And for the ordinary people, it's just bad. I mean, it just means, okay, your society is, it's like a ring of combat. You're on your own. It's the law of the jungle. Well, yeah. What kind of society is that? I mean, if a society doesn't work for the people in it, then what's the point of it? If it just creates hardship for them, what's the point of it? Is it crazy?
Absolutely. I think, but here we have a real ideological difference, you know, between like right-wing thought and libertarian thought. Because if you go back to the founding fathers of this ideology, Hayek and Mises, they already were criticizing nations. You know, they said basically any kind of tariff, any kind of immigration hindrance. I know we can talk about this deeply, but that quotes by them where they say the nation is basically something that is distorting trade and distorting the free market and meritocracy and therefore also creating worse products and so on. But that goes directly in contrast with the America First agenda by Donald Trump, where he said tariffs is his the most beloved word because and at some point the tech pros and the MAGA guys, like even the most colorblind MAGA guys, have to come to a conclusion here. But I think in the end, it's not only about solidarity and morality, because Musk said, yeah, he's a pragmatist. He just wants to win. He's very wrong here because he's a totally economist. He thinks that the world is like a market, but that's not what's the case. He's missing the political. What is motivating people to play together as a team, and he was talking about a soccer team, is always a tribal sense. Every soccer team has a tribal root. There is no Red Bull team. There's no SpaceX team. There's American football team. There's a Canadian one. Then if you go down, it's the Washington Red Sox and I don't know how they're called, you know. And it's always a tribal thing. And of course, you sometimes can get better people in. I think that's always possible. There's always some kind of assimilation, but it always has to protect this we, this notion of the we, this identity, which is political and not economical. And the only way to move masses, to create a space program, to create airship carriers, to create armies is tribal identity, which is in the end an in-group and an out-group, keeping people out, even if there might be better. And I think that's where they're mistaking. They think you can just get all the talents in and then you create kind of an economical quasi-nation, but that doesn't work and that is impossible. It's universalism and it has always failed because real concrete political order always forms about tribal identities. And I understand that Musk is an entrepreneur, doesn't like this so much and he has no real feel for the political idea. But even he works within the frame of the Pax Americana, of the American political order, which is controlling resources and exploiting resources that he needs for his products. And so in the end, he will have to accept that the political plays a role.
Do you think that there's an expression, I'm sure you've heard it, all politics is identity politics. Do you think that's true? Or do you think it's possible for there to be some politics that isn't tied to groups?
Completely agree with you. That's completely how I see it because politics, we know it, comes from politeia, comes from a community, and every community is an identity, a collective identity, which is collecting individuals around a shared idea. This can be a nation, it can also be a religious identity, anything actually. And obviously, to have a politics, you need an identity first. So I think being against identity politics is stupid. What they actually mean is left-wing Marxist identity politics, and I'm also against that, but I'm for identitarian identity politics. And identitarian identity politics always wants to bridge between differences. It wants to integrate. It wants to create a harmony between women and men, between rich and poor, between old and young. And even if there are, for example, like ethnic minorities in the country, like we have in Germany, the Sorbs, or we have some Hungarians in Austria, a real identitarianism also wants to integrate those natural ethnic minorities into the country, like a lot of the medieval empires did. And Marxist identity politics always tries to stir up hatred, get one identity group, create a universalistic collective, the universal of trans people, of women, of workers, whatsoever, you know, and then you lead them in a rebellion against the state. And in that sense, the criticism of Marxist identity politics is right. But obviously, as so often, if you universalize it and think you can do away with identity at all, then it goes very, very wrong. You just create a new universalism, which is not the right thing to build a state and a political ideology on.
Well, yeah, and it seems to be that the center-right, the centrist, is the only person who actually thinks in that way. I'm not even convinced that they really do think in that way, because I think their own life choices might betray that they actually do care about groups. But whatever, their politics are this very detached. It's all about principles and systems and fairness and so on, and individual. Everyone is an individual. But they are the only ones who see things that way, I think. Everyone else, and of course, this is the thing where they congratulate themselves, you know, like Sargon of Akkad back in the day, 10 years ago. But not now, I have to say. He seems to have grown from that. But they congratulate themselves for not seeing groups.
Yeah.
I always think it's like a colorblind guy congratulating himself for not seeing different colors.
It's a virtue, you know.
It's a disability. It's a handicap. It's not a virtue.
Yeah. But it's true. I mean, that's it's a fake consensus. They all see groups. But I think what about Elon Musk? Because I think he's a fascinating and interesting person. I think he's a net positive. I'm very grateful that we can do this stream on X. And I think also like X and this relative freedom of speech we have here is like very, very important. I hope it stays like that. But I think he's an apolitical thinker because he always thinks in terms of Mars, you know, bring humanity to Mars. So that humanity already exists as a block that needs to become interplanetary and interstellar already is kind of a given for him. So he doesn't even think in terms of national politics and geopolitics as so much. I think he just thinks, okay, all this quarrel and fighting should stop, that humanity can finally text and take the next step. And I think that's the terms he thinks of. And he basically sees the United States as a system in which he wants to create the best possible conditions for this next step to happen. So that's I think how he understands the world. I think it's very important to understand Musk because he's a very important figure, and I think it's very important to don't have put false hopes on him, and then be very aggressive and angry when he doesn't fulfill those hopes.
Yeah, do you think that he is going to be? Because some people think that this is overestimated and he's just a businessman and he's not important. I think he is very important and I think he's going to be more important in the future. So this is why people talk about it. That's why you and I are talking about him right now, because he's not just another businessman. And this is true whether you like him or hate him, I would say.
Absolutely. I mean, people back then were talking about Napoleon because he was just basically, you know, sweeping over the continent and destroying the old order. And that's in a way what he's doing in terms of media. I just, to be honest, hope that people understand now you never can go all in into a social platform. All this splendor could be over by tomorrow. And I hope people act accordingly and also, for example, follow you on Rumble, me on Telegram. And I really think that we still need some kind of alt tech. So we cannot afford that. If censorship comes again from one day to another, we lose all these connections, all this synergy, all this network effect again.
Yeah, Martin's links should be in the description. I don't think I've got your Rumble channel there, but I'll add that after the fact, after this stream is finished. But yeah, I agree with you. We shouldn't be complacent. We've actually seen just over the last few days that Musk or his staff have censored people who disagreed with him on the H-1B thing. So I don't know if anyone... Well, a lot of the Groypers got banned. I think other mm-hmm. people, like Laura Loomer, got...
Demonetized.
Demonetized, that's the word. Yes, thank you. Yeah, demonetized. I mean, it's rather surprising because up until now, Musk's Twitter has been... This is a big change where people have disagreed with him, so now they're getting punished. And, you know, it does bring to mind the complaints that a lot of leftists had, that it's terrible for one man to be in charge of a platform. Well, it kind of is. I don't really know what to say about that.
I completely agree with you. It's not a good situation that one platform like really hangs on the thread of one person and his opinion that can change from day to day, his convictions that can also change. But this one person creating and buying this platform was the only possibility to create this relative freedom of speech in this systematic censorship that we had with Silicon Valley. So there was no way around Musk. And obviously only a guy like Musk with his point of view could become so big in such a world that we live in. So there is no other possibility that any CEO secretly is a dissident right guy and then creates such a platform and is not completely destroyed and killed before. And somebody who has our conviction and in a way shows it to other people could never become that big to begin with in such a system. So I think it's a systematic problem that Musk is the best thing that we can get. And I also think it's very important to understand that's just the way it is. And if you see how Musk works and how he behaves, I think it's stupid to uselessly antagonize him. So people who now like make constant like hate memes about Musk and said, I shouldn't be deleted if I do this on X and then get deleted. Okay, I mean, I understand the worry and I don't think it's an ideal situation, but that's just the way it is. And I think we should try to use this platform as much as possible to further our ideas as much as we can. And although it's not ideal, clamoring on this very platform about this, attacking the person who owns the platform about the status quo will not achieve anything. Prove maybe a moral high ground, but it doesn't have any effect when you are deleted. So I also think a lot of people who use this platform should try to use it in a way that also really reaches people like Musk. And we've seen it that he reacted very differently to people who brought very data-based, data-driven, very rational, very calm criticism of the HP1 stuff up. He reacted very differently to that. So I don't want to sugarcoat it. I don't want to basically shill for him. The things have been said by him, by other tech bros that are unacceptable for whites living in America. But just saying something shouldn't be like that doesn't make it go away. And people should understand the reality. That's why I call myself a remigration realist and act according to this reality.
Yeah, it is the situation that we're in. And I don't think that we should throw it away, Twitter. And even that potential contact with Elon Musk himself. I mean, other people have said this, that we should not attack him on a personal level because he still is a very influential figure and it's possible that you could get through to him. I don't know about that, but I do think we've got nothing to lose by trying.
If you really like want to do this, you should argue in a way that a person like him understands it, follows it, and I think he is kind of a logical person. So if there's a really logical thing that is no logical arguments against it, you know, then it's quite hard. So I think he's following this idea of logical argumentation. But then if you make it very easy for him to ban you and give him a reason for him to ban you, then actually you're not doing yourself a favor. So that's how I see it. But still, I think for me, this whole thing was a bit disillusioning. Or how do you call it in English? Like it was a disappointment, disappointing. That's what it was, because I really hoped that one very clear win of the Trump victory would be relative freedom of speech for at least 1 year here on X. And this now, in my opinion, not so sure anymore. So also for myself, I won't rely on X too much anymore in the future. Like I'll do a lot of stuff here and I try to use it as much as possible, but I just try to mentally prepare myself for maybe a big purge.
See, you're very used to getting banned from things. You've lost platforms in the past. So have I. And so I think we're sort of accustomed to this now. It's not going to shock us to get banned from Twitter or whatever. It's something that, I don't know about you, but it was bad the first time. I think we did speak about this, that you missed Instagram more than Twitter. I think I remember you saying that. But yeah, it's bad the first time, but after that, you know, you're just going to take it in stride. And you have to be like that, because of course it could happen at any time. Well, to get back to the issue of the AFD, we talked about the background, the history of it, and the current condition. What would you, if you were to predict the future for the next 5 years or the next, well, yeah, let's say 5 years of the AFD, what do you think is most likely to happen? Like, where do you think it will be 5 years from now?
In 5 years, I hope that the AFD will at least be governing the eastern provinces of Germany in coalitions that they're leading together with either like more rational CDU parties or with completely new parties that formed under, I hope, crumbling of the old conservative Merkel CDU party. I hope that the big system, like the national level in Germany, will become ungovernable without the AfD. And there is an Italian system where one government forms and breaks and forms and breaks one after another, and the AfD is the only opposition party, gets stronger and stronger. Might be even the case. It depends totally, in my opinion, on the economic situation that the AfD already could be in a government. But I think the AfD should only go into a government, same for the Freedom Party in Austria, when it can be the absolute dominant force in a government. And whenever they are in a government and they are unable to deliver, they have to crush this coalition, go out of the government, block everything, and then go in a back stronger. Because the moment when they do a foul compromise, they lose their only capital, which is authenticity. And once they've lost this, we've seen it with the Freedom Party, they will go down like 10%, 12% and have to build up again. And we don't have this time. So that's my hope. And in my opinion, it depends also on how dire the situation will get. I think we're going to have some very brutal years, because in the final phase of the population replacement, which is always the most brutal one, the ethnic shocks we see all the time, you know, the Christmas market in Germany, the terror attack in Solingen, the live stream terror in Mannheim. I call this ethnic shocks, and they happen. They will happen again and again. It's impossible that they won't happen, because you have this large mass of young men who have a low education, who have a high, high, deeply religious, you know what I mean? Yeah,
and religious, religiosity. Yeah.
So let's say that they're very, they are able to take risks, and they are also very often prone to violence. And this is just happening. This will produce these ethnic shocks on a weekly, monthly basis. It will become more often, more brutal, and every one of these shocks is moving the Overton window to the right by itself. And that's why I think that things that seem now radical in 1 year will be the new normal in Germany. So that's why I think that the AfD should not sell itself too early and too quickly. And the only way, in a way, to prevent some kind of remigration shift would be to completely co-opt the right, to kick out all the good people and create a fake opposition.
Yeah, that point you made about going into a coalition government as the minor partner, and then that discredits you, that's exactly what happened with the Liberal Democrat Party in Britain in 2010. They went into a coalition with the Conservative Party, and the Conservatives were the majority, the more powerful partner. And immediately, the Liberal Democrats had to compromise on their principles. They had to go along with things that they hadn't advocated, and that just destroyed them. And I think the party has never recovered from that. And 14 years later, so I think you're absolutely right. It would be a what we call a poison chalice. It would be a trick. It would be a Pyrrhic victory. It'd be a mistake for the AfD to accept any place in government until they are the deciding, the majority partner, until they've got the actual power. Because otherwise, I think it would just work against them. So I completely agree with you. On the other point about things becoming sayable and even normal, which 5 years ago would have been inconceivable. It would have seemed extremist. Obviously, the thing that springs to mind there is the concept of remigration or remigration. Let's talk about that now, because this is something that I associate very much with you. I know that you didn't come up with the concept in the first place, but I think you have done more than anyone else to popularize it and spread it around, promote it. So I think you really deserve a huge amount of credit for this. And would you like to tell people just explain it freshly in your own terms, what is remigration and why is it taking off now as a concept?
Yeah, I think it's a very important concept, very important idea. I didn't invent it. Actually, nobody really invented it. It's just a scientific term that was there all the time, means people going back to where they came from or where they belong to. It was used in several contexts and was more used in the scientific sociologist context. And then it was made political in France by the French identitarian movement and French right wingers. And then we in 2016, we imported it to Austria. And then with our activism, I think we made it quite popular. So basically, remigration for me is an umbrella term for many different political, cultural measures that in the end will shift and turn the tides and streams of remigration, stop the Great Replacement, and keep the indigenous population, the dominant majority, the dominant culture in the country. So that's basically the idea of remigration. I define it by its goal. It should stop the Great Replacement and should keep and maintain the identity of this nation and of this country. And therefore, obviously, you need an array of different political measures. Remigration means securing your border just as much as it means to bring illegals home, repatriating illegals. It means reforming your citizenship law, obviously, just as it means also to reform, totally reform the asylum law. It means cultural efforts, but also an economic reform that cuts all the pull factors that brings people in. And a very important step also of my solution to remigration is to create remigration zones, safe spaces, yeah, cities even, charter cities in North Africa, to which people who cannot go to the homeland, people who are illegal, people who are being pushed back, can go to live there in security and safety, but not having to enter Europe. So it's very hard to just pin it down a few words, but I try to describe it. And the difference between remigration is that it's this overall term, this vision, this idea that we cannot only stop illegal immigration, but we can undo this whole experiment of multiculturalism. We can stop the Great Replacement and we can become a majority in our own countries again. That's for what remigration stands for. And all the other things are just little tools and little tiny things. And they're just sometimes too small, like stop the reform the asylum system, stop illegal immigration, kick out criminals. All these things are true, but they're just in itself too short and they lack a bigger vision. And I think that's why the idea of remigration is so compelling. Although I have to say, obviously, many people have different definitions of remigration. The Homeland Party has a very good paper on it in the UK. And I just basically proposed mine. That's why my book is called Remigration, a Proposition.
Right. Okay. Do you think that the popularity of the concept, do you think that it depends on people believing in the Great Replacement? Because this has been a big thing in itself, that I mean, the Great Replacement is still now officially called a conspiracy theory. It's something that the mainstream they still deny it. They still say that it's a racist, far right conspiracy theory, all the rest of it. Generally speaking, obviously, believe in the Great Replacement? They believe it's real?
Absolutely. If you ask them, do you believe in the conspiracy theory of the Great Replacement, that shadow elites are trying to replace us, obviously the majority will not say yes. But if you ask them, do you believe that your country is getting more and more foreign every day? Do you believe that there are fewer and fewer areas where you want to live as a British person, as an American person, as an Austrian person? Do you believe that there are too many foreigners in your country? Do you think at some point your country will have lost its identity? Most people will say yes. And this understanding of our replacement by replacement migration is completely agreed. The first step, the Great Replacement is the problem. Remigration is the solution. So they go hand in hand. But obviously, remigration is a better battle cry, because people obviously like a solution and a vision more than just pointing out the issue and the problem.
Yeah, yeah. On the right, we're very accustomed to just talking about problems and diagnosing the problem and describing the problem. I think the other side of it is much rarer. And I think this is where you are so valuable. What would you say about, do you think that the right in Germany, in Austria, is is in a better position, in a better sort of mentality now than it has been in, you know, in the last 50 years, let's say? Do you think it's more solution oriented now, or is that specifically the identitarian?
No, 100%. I would say the right in the Germanosphere is in its best state ever, because we are so strong now on all the important levels and fronts. You know, we have a very strong counter public. So I think like a movement consists of five different branches, which is media, activism, a political party, theory, and culture. So this everything anyone does can be put in one of these categories. And in all of these five categories, we are stronger than ever. Counterculture is the only thing lacking a bit. You know, there are not so much right-wing music groups and bands. But also, if you look at the meme culture, if you look at the Gigi D'Agostino song, the famous remix one, you know, that was got popular and went viral. There's also a lot of things going on there. So we are strongest than ever in media. Activism, the movement, is also strong and organized. The political parties are stronger than ever, plus they're not distancing themselves so much anymore. So there's a really flow of ideas coming from right-wing groups, right-wing activist groups, right-wing Twitter, going directly into political parties. And then we have, in my opinion, also a very interesting dark academia, which is becoming global right now, an alternative market of right-wing ideas that is also more interesting, more fascinating, more multidimensional as ever before. So I really think we're in a very good position. And I think that's also because of this huge amount of repression. Because if you put some people, it's the famous dialectics of Hegel, you know, of the Lord and the peasant. We have been under so much pressure and repression for such a long time that we have to become way more quicker, way more creative, way more funny. We have to be able to condense something very quickly into one sentence because we don't have more time because of repression and more space. And that's what's making us very effective.
Yeah. I have to say, I loved the Auslander Raus, that whole thing that happened this year. And even that video, our mutual friend Lichtmess hates that video, as you might know.
I know.
Because he doesn't like AI. But I thought it was hilarious. And I especially, I'm going to show my favorite part from that video was this bit. Which is the airline pilot who's also a DJ. I thought that was brilliant.
And you know, this was a huge hit. There was a very small guy, graphic guy, who designed this with a minimum budget, and the youth movement of the AfD just made it themselves with their own budget, and millions clicked it, and was a huge viral sensation. Obviously, the press said, like, it's tasteless, it's mean, it's crazy. But a lot of young people really like it, and I think that's the most white-pilling thing happening in Germany and Austria. It's the awakening of the youth and the awakening of the woman. For the first time in history, in the party history of the Freedom Party, the same amount as men and women voted for the Freedom Party this fall. And I think it's very interesting because women are the best seismographs for a shift in cultural power, for the death of one historic bloc after Gramsci, because women understand it, they sense it when something has lost its drive, its energy, power. And I think that's what's happening right now.
Well, absolutely. This is something that we've talked about for years. You want the female, the women on board with something, because then that acts as another galvanizing force, because then they bring more men in and it becomes more of a social thing, and it becomes more, women will take it out into society in a way that men aren't so good at doing. I mean, I think it obviously is going to start with men. Any movement, any new idea is probably going to start with men, because that's to do with male nature. But and then it's going to remain with men for a while it's the Spergy phase. But then once the women get on board, it's a huge step up. I mean, it's a huge threshold to cross. So I completely agree with you. This is a great sign. Very good. Very good indeed.
And, you know, I think it's always like very often people say, we have to get women on board because basically then we have won. I think that's the wrong way. You just have to become very strong, very attractive. And when you've reached this critical mass and you have reached this point, then it also happens. The women feel safe. Then they lose trust in the ruling ideology because you basically have undermined the authority of this wrong ideology in a way. You've created a counter authority. You have your own style. You're very attractive in terms of your memes. You're very funny, you're dynamic. And then also a lot of women feel more safe and secure by going to your movement than sticking with the old elites.
Exactly. It's a sign that that your movement is not nerdy anymore. So it's that phase, which is, in a way, it's a sad moment. It's like when the thing becomes bigger and it's not so cozy anymore. But of course, this is the whole point. This is its destiny. If it doesn't do that, it will never become victorious. It will never take over society and so on. So of course, that phase has to happen.
Some people also never want to become mainstream. You know, they basically see the political ideology like a band, which they want to stay underground. But I can reassure these people, they don't have to be afraid. We will not get mainstream so fast. And obviously, we always need a radical flank. We will always need an avant-garde that just goes one step further and basically prevents us from freezing and from stopping.
Yeah, and you can always say that you were into it before it was cool.
Exactly.
You've always got that few dots. All right, there were some super chats. This is from Daniel, and he asks, "What, in your opinion, what should Europe's geopolitical position be in the future? What would be a positive vision, and what role does remigration play in that?" I think we've talked about that already, but you can take the question.
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think Europe needs to become sovereign or Europe will die. Because what's happening right now with the Ukraine conflict, when it's frozen in, it will become very dangerous because it can be made hot at any point again. And if Europe has no power block in itself, no strategic autonomy, Europe will become like a huge 30-year war scenario where with every conflict, you have all these foreign powers sending the MS. Now we have North Koreans, you know, fighting against Australian Western guys in our European ground in Ukraine. And if this happens and also goes to Poland, then we'll face a brutal decade in which even more of Europe's demographic treasure will be destroyed. So I hope that Europe now uses this wake-up call from history, this war that should never have happened in the first place, in my opinion, to emancipate itself from NATO, from the United States, creates a strategic autonomy with we have atomic warheads already in France. We just need to combine the French military mind and military strategy with the German economy. And then at some point, we can finally become an actor again on the world scale. And obviously, also, this will help us by creating remigration treaties with other countries. But I'm a remigration first maxer. So I like geopolitical ideas, but if we don't have a people, we also will not have a political possibility. So I don't think that geopolitics will be the area where we achieve a breakthrough. I think it will and has to be remigration.
Right, excellent. The thing is, I just like to say it is so interesting because the remigration thing seems like it just feels like a solution. It feels like that would be society healing from a lot of the damage, a lot of the dysfunction whether it's Germany, Austria, Britain, that these societies have suffered over decades. Diversity is not a strength in demographics. It's a weakness, and everyone knows that at some level, even if they don't say it. So. Yeah, remigration just it feels like something that's necessary and would only be good. be a positive.
Even on a global scale, if like a lot of Afghans and Syrians and Turkish people go home, but they still speak German and they've learned, for example, to manufacture German cars, use German tools, this could then become later a perfect bridge for economic ties with those countries where we export, for example, German tools there, where we create trade relations with those countries. So this also could work, and then they could really use the skills they learned here in Europe to really lift up their own countries. So I think remigration is also in all ways and senses the more humane way to deal with this age of mass mobility. So I think it's also of utmost importance now to not play the demon as the left wants to portray us as. So that's also a very important message I have to the Anglosphere.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I think it's extremely important that you don't play the role that your enemy has prepared for you, that they've written for you. They've done that for a reason. If you think you're going to be clever and, oh, I'll just be that thing then. If they're going to call me that, then I'll be that. That's not clever. That's walking straight into a trap. So, yeah, I agree with Martin here. You definitely shouldn't do that. All right. Big Ives said, really enjoyed Millennial this year. I just wanted to say I appreciate your work. Well, thank you very much, Big Ives. And Thin Red Line said, Martin, thank you for all you do. I think you are the man of 2024. Do you, nice. Do you think that the AfD will push for remigration in the coming years? And what about Austria? Well, we've already talked about remigration and the AfD. So what about Austria? I should have asked you that myself. I apologize.
First to the AfD, I think the AfD has to push for remigration in the coming years because, you know, the CDU will take the stance of stopping illegal immigration. So basically, they will make migration criticism mainstream. And for the moment, the AfD is so successful because nobody else touched this issue. And it wasn't because the AfD had so great politicians. I always say you could put a cactus in front of a camera and just put a little poster there, stop migration, and people would vote for this cactus. And very often this cactus would have been a better option than many right-wing politicians we've seen in the past years. And now, for the first time, they have concurrence by politpros who have done this for decades. And if the AfD doesn't adapt to this overtone shift and really has the real deal of remigration, then they will drown into like between different demands and different ideas, and they will lose their unique selling proposition. As for Austria, I'm very white-pilled about Austria. We could maybe make a stream just about Austria. I think Austria might be the first Western European country, like part of the Western bloc, former Western bloc, that really manages to have a change, especially since Austria is so small and geopolitically not so important as Germany. Because let's face it, Germany will only have a political change if the Americans allow it, because they have Rammstein there, they have all the drones and the weapons there, and if something happens, they will manage it or they will crush it. Germany is not a sovereign state. But Austria is so small, nobody really cares about Austria so much, unfortunately, and wrongfully so. And if Austria really achieves a remigration policy on a very small scale, we are not too many people, it can act as a symbol that shows to many, many other people that it's possible. So if we could maybe have like 5-10 years of remigration in Austria and see, okay, the Vienna looks like Vienna again. There are no gang rapes anymore. Everything went down. Prices of houses went down. People can go out partying again, can go on the street, and like the whole country is healing. That would be a very, very strong symbolic victory for all of the Western and the white world.
Absolutely. And I should say Vienna is one of the most beautiful cities that I've ever been to. So you know, the idea that Austria is not important, or, yes, of course, it's not as prominent in the geopolitics as Germany, but it is a valuable country. I just want to say that it's a country that I do have a lot of affection for. All right, and then Darby said, it's fitting that Martin Selner gets his own standalone stream after seeing all of his hard work paying off this past year. Congrats to him. Yes, it is, to be honest. I'm glad that we're doing this. So, people are very impressed. Alt White said, we need to be competitive on the world stage, but we also need to be aware of our identity. These two goals do not conflict. This is to do with when we were talking about the H-1B thing, and I think I said something that a society should protect its people. It shouldn't just open them up to global competition. I agree. Obviously, we need competition, but we need both. As you say, it's not either or.
I think the most important thing is that every kind of like migration changes your identity. So if you say we need to be successful, every kind of migration mustn't harm this we. And if you put it in a metaphor, identity, ethnocultural identity in the ship is like the hull of the ship, and economy is like the sail. But if you have a hole in it and the ship doesn't work anymore, the best sail doesn't help and you will go down.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, this is about preserving things that are valuable, because if you don't, then you won't be able to compete. It's obvious. All right. Denise Kelt says some very negative things about Elon Musk. He's a childish, shallow, narcissistic grifter. I never actually heard him speak until a few days ago. I was shocked by his insufferable arrogance and lunacy. He sounds like an obnoxious, spoiled 13-year-old mean girl. His money comes from US tax slaves. His family connections are his talent. Well, look, I don't think that Elon Musk is the best person who's ever lived. But I do think I'm guessing he must have some talent. Otherwise, he wouldn't have been able to become as wealthy as he is. Martin, do you want to say anything about that?
Yeah, I think criticism always needs to be measured and realistic. And to claim that Elon Musk was just uplifted by the elite and like groomed by the elite and he never did anything to deserve his rise from his family background is, I think, crazy. It's not true. And also, I think his fall off with the system was very genuine, because everything he did, like Tesla and SpaceX and so on, he could still be the love child. He could have endorsed Kamala Harris and gone on this colorblind, democratic bandwagon. I think that obviously he's not perfect. Obviously, he's not our guy in the sense that he has our ideology. But as I've mentioned before, in the circumstances, the system, I think he's the best billionaire who is creating relative free speech that we can have, possibly have. It's not perfect, but I think we also shouldn't just overreact in the criticism.
Yeah, I agree. Alt-White said, Selner is the only person who has proposed a detailed and fair remigration plan. Kudos to you for that, Martin.
Thank you.
Yeah, I think the Homeland Party and Patriotic Alternative both published plans of their own for this. But obviously, Martin has written a book about it, so it's obviously a big thing in itself. All right, and Chips and Salsa said, great interview, huge respect and admiration for Martin's consistency over many years and his refusal to cuck to the regime. Tougher in Europe than in America. And also for he and Brittany setting a great example with marriage and children. Much love to you both.
Well, thank you very much.
Yeah, a nice message. And then there was one more from Ye Gads. Hi, Woz. Thanks for all you do. Question for Martin. Would he consider starting a transnational European political party or organization as an anti-globalist movement? We have many people spread across many countries and we need to unify, in my opinion.
I completely agree. I think a transnational party would be a bad idea, because there's so many peculiar detailed things about Slovakia, even, which is a neighboring country. I have not much idea about the politics of Slovakia, that a transnational party would fail. But we definitely need a unification. And I won't spoil anything right now, but on the 1st of January, I'm going to share something, a new project that actually wants to achieve that, unite people who believe in remigration across Europe. So we are working on something. We have been working on something. We're going to release it on the 1st of January, 25.
All right, excellent. Well, I think this has been a very fast-paced interview, but we've covered a lot of different ground. Is there anything else that you'd like to say before we finish?
Actually, I think I've covered much. I've talked a lot. I've ranted and put some monologues. Thank you very much for letting me finish. Also, sorry for people who watched. If I couldn't find a word or something like that, I'm really quite tired. I've been on the road the whole day and didn't sleep much. I'm not perfect in English, but I think in this stream it might have been sometimes a bit annoying. I hope you, what I meant still came across.
Oh yeah,
I'm very positive about 2025. People should be. And I just want to urge everybody to do their part, to also organize their life around remigration about around a political change, because if we don't do it right now, if we don't use this chance we have, we're going to get a fake remigration or a fake political change, or we won't get a change at all. And I don't think there'll be another solution to have a different politics. If you don't use this window, the only solution will be like Oranias all across the West. And I don't want that. I want to keep Austria, Germany, Europe, and you should want it too.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Well, let's leave it there. I think this has been a really good interview. So thank you very much. I'll be back in 25 minutes with Morgoth. But in the meantime, Martin Selner, thank you for appearing on Millennial X.
Thank you for the invitation.
We hope you're enjoying Millennial. The festival goes on, but how about giving something back to your tireless host? There are many ways to make a cash donation. Find all of these at millennial.com/donate. Your kindness will be warmly appreciated. Millennial amounts to 3 months of work for the vile vlogger. Please help him to keep the lights on.